from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Oakland has emerged as a central city in the international Occupy movement due to violent clashes last Tuesday night between protesters and police and the serious injury of a 24-year-old Iraq war veteran, Scott Olson. Meanwhile, San Francisco's tent city remains, and there was a swelling over this past weekend with a call for critical mass. We'll get an update on the Occupy movement in the Bay Area and across the nation in the Forum hour ahead, and we'll key in on the local and national political implications of the movement. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We've now seen the occupation movement of populist activists calling themselves the 99%ers in hundreds of cities across the United States, a movement of many with mixed motives and varying causes, but impelled largely by feelings of anger at Wall Street and government, bank, and corporate bailouts, economic inequality and corporate greed, and overall disenchantment from middle-class American dreams. A focal point of the protest of this international movement has been in Oakland, where violent clashes between protesters and police occurred just last week. San Francisco's tent city remains and is growing, and an encampment in San Jose also continues to grow and flourish. And in this morning's opening Forum Hour, we want to turn our attention once more to the 99ers, the occupation movement here in the Bay Area and beyond. Joining us in studio is Joe Garofoli, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning.
Good morning.
And well represented, the Chronicle is indeed today. Deborah Saunders is also with us, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, who also is nationally syndicated. Good morning, Deborah Saunders.
Good morning, Michael.
And good morning to Tim Dickinson, who's contributing editor of the Rolling Stone magazine. Good to have you all here.
Good morning.
Let me begin, Joe, with you, just to get an update. There's a general strike that's been called Wednesday in Oakland. They're saying they're going to shut down the port, and the mayor seems to be at least amenable. They've demanded medical care be returned to them, medical facilities, I guess, that they had, and there's dialogue opening up. This all seems to be at least a kind of positive move forward.
Well, it's a positive move forward, I guess. There's still a lot of resentment towards Mayor Gene Kwan in Oakland. I was actually out there yesterday. There's signs all over there saying, you know, there's an impeachment petition.
Recall,
gathering.
Isn't it?
Recall,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
sorry. Movement towards her, a lot of resentment towards her. She was booed when she came down there the other day to try and engage the protesters. And in San Francisco, nothing will happen because there's an election for mayor next week. And so Ed Lee is not going to risk doing anything there so close to the election. So maybe November 9th we might see some action there, but not before.
How do you read the movement generally, though? I mean, there's been concern about the weather back east, and it seems the weather is dampening the spirits of many of those. In fact, Pat Buchanan has said, you know, this is the end of the movement as soon as the winter comes in.
Well, it does. They do face a very real deadline of winter moving in. It's camping outside in the snow is not going to be as appealing to people. And so the movement at this point, and they, internally they're saying this, as well as others, they need to evolve into something else. They need to take the next step as a movement. And they can't get, if they continue to camp and stay, you know, coming outside for rallies that really are just about, you know, expressing frustration and stuff, only goes so far. If for this to be a sustainable movement, it has to take the next step.
And what might that be, in your judgment, Tim Dickinson? Certainly, labor has moved into the fray, so to speak. President Obama has said he understands the frustrations or hears them and so forth. Could this actually be, well, a movement in sort of conjunction with or like the Tea Party?
You know, I think so. And I think this general strike is going to be an interesting and sort of instructive moment, whether this movement, which has so far just been about expressing anger and trying to change the conversation, succeeds in taking that next step and transforming into a series of events. We've seen protesters in Iowa going down to Obama campaign headquarters as a protest. And so, you know, it's going to be this interesting dynamic as to whether Obama can – you know, he's not going to get out in front of these protesters, but is he going to lose contact with them? Is this going to be the activist left organizing on its own, yeah, apart from the presidential campaign and perhaps in contest with the presidential campaign? You know, and are we going to see a repeat of 1968 when we get to the convention in Charlotte, which, of course, is a giant banking town. So this is going to be, you know, there's a lot of storylines that are moving here. And I don't think for a second that this is going to go away just because of the weather. I think with the internet and, you know, you can have virtual protests. This is going to be ongoing. Something is alive here. The question is to whether and how it grows and whether it's continues to be something that could be seen as broader based, or whether it starts to self-marginalize more as a identifiably lefty Michael Moore movement.
Well, he has come front and center here in Oakland, in fact, as a spokesman for this movement. I think he's in the 1% of income, though.
He's pretty close.
Yeah. Deborah Saunders, how are you reading things at this point? I mean, there are a lot of storylines, as Tim Dickinson suggested. There are scores who were arrested in Denver, and mace was used, and, of course, what happened in Oakland may be instructive about at least the volatile possibilities of this. You got people like Glenn Beck saying these are anarchists, and there's going to be more and more violence. How do you read it?
Well, I think things are only going to deteriorate. I look at this and I think, I know there are a lot of people who have done the Tea Party comparison, but the Tea Party people didn't just camp out and they didn't take over public property and they didn't basically trespass. I think that a lot of people are looking at the Occupy movement as people who are trying to flout the laws and get away with things that nobody else could do. And a lot of people look at Oakland and they see, first of all, no liberal politician is safe because Jean Kwan is about as far left as you can get. But she felt pressure to do something about what was going on at Occupy Oakland because it was unhealthy, very unsanitary. They have their own vigilante crew of security that apparently beat up a homeless man who had attacked somebody. And it's scary what's going on at these places. And at any time, it's some of these places, something really ugly can go on. We saw reports of rape in New York. And so I think a lot of Americans are looking at this and thinking these are a bunch of spoiled kids who don't even have an agenda, don't have real political demands, and they're trying to get away with something other people couldn't get away with.
Many of them, however, are kids deeply in debt who graduated college, who can't find a job, who are disenfranchised, who have been idealistic and have had that idealism thwarted. I mean, you must concede that there are a lot of them who are out there with a sense of, well, certainly establishing their First Amendment rights and protesting.
Well, Michael, I have a lot of sympathy when I see some of these kids with signs that say $60,000 in debt and I can't get a job, you know, $90,000 in student loans. And I feel deeply for these people. I can only say that doesn't give them permission to camp out in front of City Hall. And it doesn't give them license to throw things at police officers. So if you want to be listened to, I think you try to play by the rules a little bit more. Have your demonstrations during the day, go home at night.
Tim Dickinson?
I mean, I'm curious which movement you've been watching, because I think that the president certainly and Congress are being able to see what the agenda is here. I mean, you see President Obama sort of moving into the space that the Occupy movement has started to create when he came out last week with a series of proposals to, you know, executive measures to help reduce student debt, to help stop foreclosures, get a floor under the housing market. You know, we even saw an indictment of a former Goldman Sachs partner. So I think Washington is perking up and listening to the demands that are real out there. There's no, you know, 10-point list of what everybody in the movement agrees to, but I don't think we have seen that anywhere, that people have taken to the streets and camped out like in Tahrir Square. And so, you know, by your logic, the Egyptians would have been right in cracking down on Tahrir Square over sanitation issues. So I think we're missing the point that this is about people taking a fundamental liberty, their right to self-expression, and their right to voice their anger at their government. And, you know, sometimes zoning laws and the rest of it are secondary.
It's also, though, true, is it not, Joe Garofoli, that you have real health and safety issues here, and you have some rotten apples, so to speak, who are really wanting to attack the police and be anarchic.
And it's also sort of – they're a separate entity than the people who are – a lot of the people who are out there. And any protest movement in the Bay Area, we'll say, there's always a significant contingent of anarchists, sort of self-styled anarchists, and there could be a peaceful march for whatever cause, and then towards the end – of the scheduled march or the scheduled demonstration, these anarchists will take off and start playing cat and mouse with the cops. It's the same crew at every type of protest. They don't care what the cause is. They just want to sort of antagonize the police. This happened the other night, Saturday night, I believe, in Oakland. Largely peaceful all day. The self-styled anarchists took off and started going marching towards the police headquarters. Then, and I was talking with one of these people, the actual protesters, they stood, four or five of them, in between the anarchists and the police and said, "Hey, mellow out. Don't do this. This is not what we're about." So there's these there's these sort of competing agendas there. And one agenda is just to antagonize the cops.
Deborah Saunders, you see that as a major agenda?
Well, I think Joe puts it quite well. I mean, we've seen this, for example, for the Oscar Grant protests, where there are people who have very valid concerns about what happened with the Oscar Grant and have tried to protest in a peaceful manner.
Many of these in Oakland are the same people because they've renamed the square Oakland.
Oscar Grant Plaza from Frank Ogawa. So we understand that there are some valid concerns. The question is, you know, and also, by the way, let's add the third element here, which is there are a lot of homeless people who have just moved in to these encampments because free food, you know, it's a better place to be homeless. So you've got the political arm, the peaceful political arm. You've got the anarchist, angry, somewhat violent on occasion arm. And then you've got a lot of homeless people who are piggybacking off of other people's issues. You know, I think that's a fair thing to say.
Well, it is a mix, certainly. But Tim Dickinson, you've pointed out you got probably twice the number of people here than you have in the Tea Party.
Right. I mean, this is a broad-based, at least it's not quite clear what the movement looks like, but certainly the support for the Occupy movement nationally is much stronger than the Tea Party, and the Occupy movement is much more popular than anybody in Washington at this point. And so I think you know, when we're going to see some real changes when, you know, let's look at the OPD. This is a police department that has been beset by layoffs. They've had their pensions cut. These are the 99%. And so I think you're going to see a real change if and when the police take off the helmets, put down the tear gas canisters, and start crossing the barricades. And I think that's – right now we've got this antagonism between the police and the Occupy movement in Denver, in Oakland. And that's sort of creating the side story, which is ancillary to the main point of this, which is to try and get people to focus on income inequality. And the fights with the cops make for great television and exactly. gets coverage. But the only way that this starts to change from – we've seen this before – is the way that it changes everywhere. It's when the instruments of state power, local power, change the mindset and start to think, wait a minute, these people have my interests at heart. You know, and I think, you know, even if on that bloody, you know, tear gas night in Oakland, we had seen one cop turn around and say, hey, that's, you know, let's protect this woman who's been hurt and has gotten flashbanged. You know, that could have changed the story dramatically. And I think there's potential for that to happen. I don't see that about to happen right now because we've gotten caught up in this, the police brutality and the rubber bullets and the rest of it. But I think that's where this is going to change if it changes.
Well, what about the notion that we're hearing from a lot of conservatives, Deborah Saunders, that Obama's faltering in the polls, his base isn't as strong, so the Occupy movement might serve him in a political sense. And we also are hearing that maybe, in fact, it's being well used by the Obama administration in terms of creating a greater sense of what they keep calling class warfare.
Well, I sure hope that's true, Michael, that they're trying to use Occupy Wall Street. Look, they're not – I mean, let's just get real here for a second. They're not the 99%. We know that about 88% of the country is employed. Now, a lot of people don't like their jobs and they're not happy, but they're not the 99%. And if – I don't understand why President Obama would try to make people think that 99% of Americans fall into this category, because if it's true, he's really failed. I mean, if that's what they're thinking they want to do.
Are you saying these are all unemployed people who are out there?
No, but look, I read the early what is the 99%, and the 99% were, you know, they would frequently say that they were unemployed. They had the big college debt or they had a lot of credit card debt. But in fact, as we know, I know that some are unemployed. Scott Olson, the Iraq vet who was hurt, holds down a job. But I don't think that, I think there are a lot of people who aren't that unhappy with the world and are certainly not so unhappy that they want to put a tent in front of City Hall and throw things at cops.
But, you know, it strikes me we haven't seen a movement anything like this since
Tea Party.
Well,
except the Tea Party.
But even before the Tea Party, thinking, you know, the so-called movement against the war in Vietnam and the disaffection, a lot of it was personal because people were getting conscripted. And now you have a lot of people out there who have a personal stake in this, Joe.
Yeah. Right, exactly. This is something that touches every neighborhood. You don't know, everybody knows in every neighborhood there's someone who's been laid off, no matter what.
Or is underwater in their mortgage.
Underwater, they've got a ton of student debt. That's what this, these campout scenes are merely the first flashpoint of an expression of anger. They're giving voice to people who are ticked off at a system where the social, where the political system they feel is unequal and broken. They feel that the economic system is unequal and broken, and they're angry. They don't know. They don't have an agenda necessarily. They don't have 20 points or whatever, but they're angry, and this is their way of expressing it. It's not pretty. It's, you know, it's very raw.
It's already having an effect. You know, I had an opportunity yesterday to just be in conversation on stage with Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor, and he was saying the story that made the headline in the New York Times about the 1% of the population, the very rich, going up in the last 20 years or so in terms of income probably wouldn't have made the front page of the New York Times if the Occupy movement hadn't been going on. So it's a different kind of coverage and news selection, isn't there?
It has literally, in fact, the Think Progress, the liberal think tank, did a study of that, and the last week of July, they studied the cable news networks. They said that the word debt, this is where over the battle of the debt ceiling, was mentioned 7,000 times on 1 week, and the word unemployed was mentioned 75 times. Now, they studied again in October, and debt was mentioned only 398 times, and Wall Street and jobs were mentioned like a couple thousand times. So it literally has changed the conversation. At least on
that's very revelatory, those numbers. And by the way, speaking of revelations, what are yours on this? We'd like to hear from you. Let me give a phone number, and you can certainly join this conversation. We welcome your thoughts and any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join us now, if you please, 866-733-6786. Again, we'd like to hear from you, and the toll-free number is yours, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post your comments, your questions on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. With us in studio, Tim Dickinson, contributing editor of Rolling Stone magazine, Deborah Saunders, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, is nationally syndicated, and Joe Garofoli, who is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. As a reporter, now you've been out there, and your sense is these people are pretty committed, huh?
They're committed, and honestly, if you go out at three different times in the day, you'll see three different types of crowds. If at night, you'll see a more aggressive crowd. I was out there yesterday afternoon. There were kids. There were a dozen kids out there. There were people doing meditation. It was kind of the mellow day in Oakland. They're doing meditation and yoga and all that stuff. Some days you'll see labor tabling there. It honestly is a very evolving scene.
Joe, you've been to many Tea Party demonstrations.
I have.
Please compare.
Well, it's definitely, the Tea Party is definitely an older crowd. And I think their concern is they were focused on, like, why is the system bailing out the big banks, which is also a concern here. There's a variety of messages at both places. You see the entire rainbow of the conservative spectrum at a Tea Party rally. You see the rainbow of the liberal spectrum at these Occupy rallies.
But don't you think in the attempt to sort of indict those on the left who try to indict the Tea Party as being racist, that we're seeing perhaps some of the same thing with respect to this movement, indicting them as being overly abundant where anarchists are concerned or something along that line?
Oh, exactly. Well, look at our political system. It's all about the tip for tat going back and forth between liberal and conservative. So it's not surprising that they're trying to indict either side now.
And how much do you think there's a possibility for those two groups coming together? Lawrence Lessig, Tim Dickinson was on this program and saying, hey, they've got a lot of the same beefs. Maybe there really is some possibility for synchronicity here.
No, and I think there's an interesting column by Tom Friedman in the New York Times over the weekend talking about linking up the Arab Spring to what's going on in America and saying that it's really less about politics and more about justice. And so that you're seeing people who have worked hard and played by the rules on both the left and the right fall behind. See their dream, you know, of a more prosperous America start to fade. Mm-hmm. And the people that they identify as being responsible for that, the political establishment and the Republicans, the bankers have not paid the proper price for that. You're seeing people, you know, continue to rake in multi-billion dollar bonuses on Wall Street.
And you're also seeing the possibility of another recession with derivatives and all of that. But don't you think a lot of this is also linked, at least where this particular occupation movement is concerned, to disaffection with Obama, the feeling that he was going to represent change and didn't bring it about?
No, I think that's right. I mean, Obama was elected on the back of a movement of his own creation. And instead of giving that movement a chance to help him govern, he sort of put them on the shelf for several years. And he said to the Wall Street bankers, I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks. And you know, now the pitchforks have come out. And is he going to stand in the way of them, or is he going to it's just interesting. His move at this point, but
he's got a lot of experience as a community organizer.
but I think that is interesting because you're seeing the left, which Cornel West said had been domesticated by Obama, wake up and have a voice of its own, and so now you're not seeing Obama representing the center and the left negotiating with the right, but you're seeing the left speak for itself and start to change the conversation and force the president himself to start addressing some of their core issues and not these questions.
So this is a left collective voice in many ways. I mean, they're not looking for hierarchy or leadership like the Tea Party, and so they've pretty much dissociated themselves from the Tea Party in that sense, haven't they?
I think so, but I think that when we're going to see some real change is when the same core issues of justice and economic fairness that I think drive both the Tea Party and the Occupy movement, if there's any crossover there, and if they start to understand that this is not there, you know, we're very used to in America being a, you know, red state, blue state, Tea Party, Occupy, but I think this is not these divisions of left and right are not so clear here, and they're not so it's not so simple, and so if it's going to take some creative organizing work to bridge those gaps. But if that starts to happen, I think you're going to see the entire political establishment then be forced to address the core issues, which are economic fairness and ability for people to get ahead.
But what you've just intimated suggests the kind of partisanship and polarization where we're at anyway, doesn't it?
Right. No, and I mean, I think you see on both sides, you see tremendous frustration with a political system that's deadlocked and dead in the water and not capable of mounting an effective response either way to the problems that we find ourselves in.
I'm going to go to a break here shortly. Tim Dickinson only has about a minute left with us. He has to leave at the half hour, but we will take your calls and your emails when we come back here. You sound pretty optimistic on the whole, though, Tim, just before we say goodbye to you.
You know, I think the ability of this movement in 6 short weeks to totally changed the national conversation. And I just incidentally happened to be writing a story about income inequality in the United States. And I had been working on this ever since the spring. And all of a sudden, what had seemed like sort of an outside the ballpark kind of thought has become, you know, a mass movement has arisen around it. And sort of, you know, so I've been tracking these issues and it's been fascinating to see how this conversation that was far to the margin is now front and center. And I think people are likely to force some sort of action from Washington to start to deal with this.
Tim Dickinson, again, is contributing editor of Rolling Stone magazine. Thank you for spending this half hour with us. We're going to continue with Deb Saunders and Joe Garofoli. And you, that is, we'll bring your calls and your emails in here as soon as we return on Forum. And again, Deborah Saunders is a columnist of the Chronicle. We're, as I said, well represented by the Chronicle here this morning. Joe Garofoli is a reporter with the Chronicle. And when we return, we'll hear from you on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Oakland has emerged as the focal point of the international Occupy movement due to violent clashes between protesters and police last Tuesday night and the injury of 24-year-old Iraq War veteran Scott Olson. And meanwhile, San Francisco's tent city remains, and it's growing, and there's an Occupy movement in San Jose and really across the country, international movement. In fact, we're getting an update on the Occupy protests here in the Bay Area and across the country, and Discussing the local and national political implications of the movement, we had Tim Dickinson on, contributing editor of Rolling Stone magazine. And here in studio, we have Deb Saunders from the San Francisco Chronicle, who is a columnist and who also has a blog, the Token Conservative blog, under her name at SF Gate. Joe Garofoli is a reporter for the Chronicle, and we are going to go to your calls and emails forthwith and your comments on the website as well as on Facebook. But I wanted to bring in Rinku Sen first, who is executive director of the Applied Research Center and publisher of ColorLines.com, which is a news website. Rinku Sen, good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And I should say that you're in New York City, and how has the cold affected things there, by the way?
Well, it was a rough weekend for occupiers here. We obviously had a really freakish snowstorm yesterday, or Saturday rather, but people's spirits seem pretty high, and folks pull together to keep things going.
Well, what about the sense of diversity in this movement, not only in New York but elsewhere? There have been concerns about the fact that seems to be, predominantly or disproportionately maybe white young men and women. How do you read it?
Well, I think that was the case at the very beginning of the movement, a month, 5 weeks ago, and it certainly was the case that the media coverage of Occupy Wall Street was really did feature large numbers of white men in particular. I think today, though, when I walk around the site here in New York, which is very close to my office, about a quarter mile from my office, I feel like the representation is fairly proportionate. And in fact, there are a lot of people of color that I know who are very attracted to the movement and who have been spending good amounts of time down there at Zuccotti Park. So I think the movement started out very white. I think it's attracted lots of people of color, and that the future is going to be determined by how much those people of color are actually able to shape the agenda.
Well, I'm seeing some mixed things on that score. On the one hand, you have the NAACP involved now, and yet John Lewis was kept from speaking in Atlanta. And in Flagstaff, on the other hand, there seems to be crossing over of color lines into Native Americans getting involved in the movement. I guess it depends maybe where you are.
I think it depends a lot on where you are, and I think it depends on how close the relationships have been between white activists and activists of color, between, you know, mainstream or predominantly white economic justice organizations and the organizations of color that might have been working on a lot of social issues in a particular place. When those relationships are tight, as they were in Flagstaff, as they were in Los Angeles, then the occupations in those places also look much more diverse and embrace an agenda that is explicitly includes people of color and explicitly has a racial analysis to it. So, like just about everything else, what history has existed influences a great deal what we actually see on the streets today.
Isn't there an Occupy Harlem going on now as we speak?
There is an Occupy Harlem going on. There was a march from town to East Harlem over the weekend or late last week. And, you know, like I said, my world is full of people of color who are racial justice activists and economic justice activists, and just about everybody I know has been involved in some occupation somewhere, one way or another.
Rinku Sen with us from New York City, again, is executive director of the Applied Research Center and publisher of ColorLines.com, a news website. Let me go to some of your emails here. Here's Max, who writes, I've been watching Occupy Oakland for a while now. I've been at every protest, observation. The consensus governance used to the occupations has a downside. The radicals who showed up early made a bunch of radical principles. Consensus now protects those principles from change by moderate newcomers unless they can come up with 90%. The movement seems to have subtle leaders, some of whom identify as anarcho-syndicalists who have ties to the Santa Cruz Sub Rosa Collective. They are successfully manipulating the conversation in many cases, and the majority of Americans will never agree with their ideals. They are not self-styled anarchists. They're organized. They have an ideology, and that ideology is wildly out of step with 99% of the 99%. Joe Garofoli?
Well, there is in New York, I was talking to someone who's been observing the movement there, and he said it's having a bit of a power struggle between the anarchists who started it, or among the people who started it, and the people who have come to the movement, because it's difficult to to join forces with some of the core members, the anarchist types, when, you know, for labor and such, when they're very mistrustful of people from the outside. So that's going to be a challenge for the movement going forward.
And Deborah Saunders, getting a number of emails along these lines. I'm appalled at the guest that said the protesters are spoiled young people with no agenda. They are the future whose job prospects are dismal thanks to Wall Street and the banks, who gave Wall Street and the banks permission to cheat the American public. Historically, revolutions occur when there is nothing left to lose, and those in power have not answered for their crimes. Didn't the original American revolutionaries fight for our right to express our opinions and fight for the pursuit of happiness? Or is it just too uncomfortable? It smacks of the establishment propaganda against the 60s revolutionaries. And here's another one for Deborah Saunders. Not to be nitpicky, but if you spend any time down here at all, you'll quickly realize it's not just a bunch of kids. The majority of the protesters aren't students. You can see this on the newspaper reports, too, or in the photographs of people in their 60s in handcuffs.
Well, I'm 56, so I can look at somebody at 30 and think they're a kid. I'm sorry. I'm not really trying to. But let me just say, I think there's a certain element of Tea Party envy that really helped spawn this, and that when the right had the Tea Party and got all that coverage, and by the way, it wasn't necessarily helpful to the right. It helped nominate certain candidates who had no chance of winning the general election. So I'm not saying that the Tea Party was a wonderful thing. It had its pluses and it has its minuses. And now you see this happening with Occupy Oakland, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy San Francisco, which I've been by. And I'm really going to be curious to see what happens on November 3rd, this day when the marchers say they're going to march on the corporations. Now, I mean, the Chronicle's already reported that there are a number of small businesses that have been quite hurt by these protests. There was a woman in San Diego. She had to close down her coffee shop, and she went out. There's a video of it. She starts yelling. She said, "I was for you people at first, but your behavior has scared away all of my customers." You know,
well, we heard some of that when we had City Administrator Santana and Interim Chief Jordan on. The businesses in Oakland have been hurt.
And what is it? I mean, Oakland is not Scarsdale, right? Oakland is a very multicultural community. There are a lot of small businesses there. There are some big corporations. Is the message going to be, you better not set up shop in Oakland? Is this good for Oakland? And so I think a lot of people who are Oaklanders have to look at this and think, I don't want this anymore. I want this to end. I don't like what's happened to the reputation of my city. And I want my city to be a good place for somebody to start a business and hire people.
Here's a listener, just to follow up on that for a moment, Anita, who writes on the web, "As a mother, full-time student, and a participant in the Occupy movement, I am very offended by your guests who appear to be implying that we are just trying to break laws. If we can't organize a city hall, then where can we express free speech?"
You just don't camp there. You can go out and organize in front of city hall all you want. You just don't set up an encampment.
Joe, you were going to say something.
I was going to say, getting back to Oakland, first of all, I think it's on November 2nd. It's on Wednesday.
I'm sorry. I get my dates mixed up.
You're
correct,
Joe. I
got my dates
wrong. I know
you're
going to be out there. So, and the average income in Oakland, some people say, well, why are you protesting in Oakland?
Here's not exactly a hegemonic power where urban centers are concerned.
No.
Financially.
The median family income is $48,000. It's certainly not the 1%. So, and you could walk three blocks from Oakland and find a million stories of people who've been hurt by what the economic forces have done. So people are wondering why there. Well, because it's been welcoming in some ways, municipally welcoming.
Well, let's welcome our callers and bring them on. And we go to Chicago first. Bill, you're on. Hi.
Thank you. Great topic. I'm just kind of curious. I've heard the buzzwords for a while of economic justice, but I've never heard any explanation of what that actually would mean in the next step. Are we talking about leveling off everyone's pay? Are we talking about government set wages? I've never heard anyone talk beyond the talking point and the bumper sticker phrases of economic justice. So I'd just like the panel to address that, and thank you much.
Thank you for that question. Rinko Sen, let me go to you on that first. What is being seen from your perspective as economic justice?
Well, it seems to me that that regulation is a big part of that economic justice agenda. So much of the suffering that people are experiencing now really has its roots in the deregulation of corporate behavior, whether it's the behavior of banks or the behavior of
chains of grocery stores, employers have just been able to get away with murder over a long period of time, as well as the financial institutions. So
forgive me, are you hearing people talk about bringing Glass-Steagall back and that sort of thing?
About New Bottom Line, for example, which is a campaign I've expressed a lot of support for, is working on a very specific platform of demands around regulating the financial markets and the finance industry. And, you know, there was a story just recently about the law firm of some of the major banks that hosts a Halloween party where the theme is homelessness. So people come dressed as homeless people. The folks that the banks have made homeless are then mocked by the industry that really did them wrong. So I think when people are talking about economic justice, they're really looking at how to get government back into the role of protecting people from corporations that would do us harm.
What are you hearing out there, Joe Garofoli?
Another thing we're talking about, concrete actions that are being taken, is a bank transfer day on November 5th, which I believe is Saturday. And they're asking folks, this is not just the Occupy, but there's many sort of, it's being spread virally online, social media, to transfer your money out of banks that you feel are major contributors to the economic collapse, that have been involved in the home foreclosures. And the funny thing is that many, and then transfer to like a credit union and such, credit unions are really reaching out. They're using this as like almost a marketing tool.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's another question, Joe. I'm going to go to you on this. This is from a listener who writes, Mayors Kwan and Lee have obviously been intimidated by the OWS encampments, but the OWS people probably don't vote. What is the political calculation of any of elected officials in treating the OWS encampments with such deference? It would seem that far more voters would welcome the setting of some basic behavioral rules and boundaries upon the OWS encampments.
Well, it's not just the people who are actually in the camps. I think they're worried about the general impression. When you're the mayor of a city and your police force fires tear gas at people, that's not good for your electoral chances, and as we can see by the recall effort. And as we said earlier with Ed Lee, he's not going to be doing anything for at least the next week or so.
Here's another listener, Stephanie in Oakland, who says, I'm not at Occupy. I'm not unemployed. I'm underpaid, financially in peril, uncertain. The people camped out are the 99% that I fit into because they have the time and wherewithal that I can't contribute right now. I personally don't have a 10-point plan either, so they are ideal trustees to express my dissatisfaction. Gretchen, join us. You're on the air. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi, I'm calling from Vallejo, California, where the house I bought in 2002 is 100% underwater now, thanks to Countrywide's practices. The only relief that's offered to me is refinancing at a longer term or a lower percent interest rate, but I'm still expected to pay the full price, or I can walk. And I don't think that's fair. The banks did this to this county. Solano County is 55% underwater. They get insurance. They get covered if people default. We get nothing. It's a bad business decision for me to keep my house at this point. But either way, I'm going to lose what I invested, or I'm going to pay twice as much as it's worth. And I feel really abandoned by the Obama administration. So while I can't afford to go to Wall Street and camp and protest where it's the most relevant, I do feel like the Occupy movement represents me better now than any politician right now.
Okay. Thank you for that. And I imagine that there are many who feel the way that caller does. In fact, we've been getting emails that pretty much substantiate that. Let me go to another Oakland caller. Hank, you're on. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I wanted to talk to Deborah Saunders about her concerns that 3 weeks of occupation is going to make Oakland a negative business environment. She doesn't seem to mention the fact that small business in Oakland can't get loans, the taxes and rentals keep going up, little neighborhoods, you know, Oakland is a city of neighborhoods, are ignored and devastated, but she thinks that 2 or 3 weeks of people camping in the plaza is going to create a negative business environment. So I'd like her to answer to the banks and the Wall Street people that created the financial situation for Oakland small business.
Well, I mean, do what you want. But if we have people marching against corporations, and I don't know what marching against corporations means, I guess we'll find out tomorrow, right? No, Wednesday. We'll find out Wednesday.
It may have something to do with a recent Supreme Court decision, don't you think?
Well, at any rate, but if they're going to send the message that if you have let's say you've got a bank in Oakland, that means that there's a chance that it will get trashed, just as we've seen a number of small businesses get trashed during the Oscar Grant protests, then it has consequences. Now, I understand that you're angry at banks. I'm angry at banks too, but I like to act in a way where I think about the consequences, and this is not going to be good for Oakland. That's one of the reasons why Gene Kwan, who's the last person who wants to go against these protesters, who has marched with the Oscar Grant people, actually decided that, that's why the police raided the place, because it wasn't good for Oakland.
A couple of other emails, Deborah, you might want to respond to. Listener writes, Deborah Saunders appears to either not be willing to acknowledge or not understand that the 99% doesn't refer strictly to unemployed Americans or Americans in default on their homes, but rather to the 99% of Americans whose incomes are stagnating at the same time that the top 1% of American earners have seen their incomes increase dramatically. And another listener, Frank, writes, has Deborah Saunders seen the CBO chart showing the income disparity in the U.S., focusing on aggressive actions of people who have been marginalized by the 1% is not a useful frame. Deborah likes to frame the discussion as though the Tea Party and OWS are equivalent and critiques behavior. Maybe she could lay out a comparison of the forces driving each group and the issues of each group to see how equivalent they are.
What?
I think we're talking again about maybe the common, shall we say, so concerns that bring the Tea Party and the Occupy movement together.
Is that it?
These are referring to the CBO study that came out last week.
Yeah, but what about that disparity? I mean, people keep calling that back, and that is the 99% in most people's minds, right?
Well, I don't know if that's the 99% in most people's minds. It's the 99%
most of the occupying people.
Minds.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And, I think it's a problem. I think the question is what you think is the answer. Do you think that having more government will be the answer or not? And obviously the 99%ers want more government action, and I don't.
Are you concerned about dramatic increase in inequality?
I'm concerned about the fact that the middle class are being squeezed, very much so. I mean, I live here. I've seen what happened to houses. It's very upsetting to see foreclosed homes in your neighborhood. And I've seen my 401k go down just like the rest of you, and the value of my home and other things. And it's rough. I just happen to believe a very different view of what is the best way to get out of this than the 99%ers.
Some thoughts about
so-called 99%ers.
What that might be without government, more regulation like we're hearing and more?
I do think that one of the smartest things that Barack Obama could do would be to really push for flatter taxes, fewer corporate loopholes, and that would be a way to get – look, we know Wall Street's sitting on money. We know that a number of employers are afraid to hire and they're sitting on money. Now, you can – There are two reasons you can think of that.
Aren't these supposed to be the job creators that we're talking about?
Well, they are supposed to be the job creators, but they're a little bit afraid that if they hire people that they're going to be stuck with a lot of mandates that make it difficult. And, I know that they're evil people, but they don't like to hire people and then fire them a week later.
Not all evil people, are they, Rinku Sen? Do you see them as evil people?
I absolutely do not see them as evil people. Commerce is a part of life, and someone has to manage it. I do think, though, that the deregulation of institutional behavior that we've seen over recent years, we used to be 98%. We used to be the 98%. Someone gave me a button a month ago that had been made a couple years ago saying we're the 98%. Now we're the 99%. So I would say even among the 1% that's left, there's some ground to lose there, even for them. I certainly agree on fewer corporate loopholes. That would be a great place to start. But this isn't about the intention of bankers. It's about the impact that the behavior of their institutions has had on the rest of the country.
Well, how about corporations as individuals and corporations in terms of campaign finance reform? I mean, is that really being part of the discourse?
Seems to be a pretty strong part of the discourse here. The We the People Project has been looking at different efforts to poke a hole in that notion that corporations have the same rights as individuals. And I think that's going to become more and more a part of the discussion as time goes by.
And we'll try to go to more and more of our callers. Bob, join us. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. The protesters talk about how the top 1% net worth has tripled in 10 years. Under Clinton, the top 1% net worth, they talk about how it doubled in the last 10 years. Under Clinton, the top 1% net worth tripled. The problem is that we were impoverishing the customers of the top 1%. The people that extended themselves this time around, as opposed to 1990, was not the commercial lending community as much as the lower and middle class who offered low interest rates in order to keep a bad economy going and use their small security foundation. In the last bust, in the 1990s, after 10 years of Republican economics, we had the failure of the SNLs that resulted in $1.5 trillion loss when the budget was necessary to bail them out through the FDIC. All these protesters are asking for is the same bailout this time around because they're the ones that have gotten kicked from the same politics and the same policies that think people live on air. And the protesters know that the FDIC bailed out the people in the 90s and people in the 80s. And so,
Bob, listen, this is getting into a bit of a screed here. I want to get them some more callers, and I appreciate his call. And we go to Mulberry next. Monique, you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have any change unless we have a viable third political party, and that's not going to happen until we have runoff elections. And so I think the focus of the Occupy movement should be to change elections both nationally and locally to have more runoff elections.
Okay, thank you for that suggestion. We'll get to more calls, and we'll go to Marcia in Berkeley. Marcia, you're on.
Yes. I'm just sort of flabbergasted by what Deborah Saunders said about how she thought most people that lived in this country were happy. Because I don't know what planet she lives on, but I live here. Most of my friends are in their 50s and getting in their 60s. We're teachers, professors, artists, and everyone I know is really stressed out and really upset because we've lost most of our money. And we're worried about retirement, and we're worried about the people that can't find jobs. And so what does she expect people to do? I think this Occupy Wall Street movement is there because people are worried, and they're angry, and they're stressed out. And if she has a better suggestion about how to change something in this country, I'd like to see what it is, because we're not going to change anything when our politicians are bought and sold.
Okay, thank you. Actually, you heard Deborah Saunders talk about corporate loopholes and other things that really need to be rectified.
I'd like to see Fannie and Freddie go private. It kills me that after everything that we've seen with the housing bubble, it's still on our shoulders, all of these big debts that are going up. So, and I don't see any movement toward that.
So careful.
That angers me.
And I'd like to see some of those people go to jail, by the way. Let me go on record and say
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I'm with you.
And in terms of politicians being bought and sold, I did a story a couple of weeks ago that looked at all the presidential candidates and their contributions from Wall Street. And all of them, all the Republicans and the president, Wall Street contributions were of the top three contributors. I mean, when I say Wall Street, I should say from the financial sector. It's 23% of Romney's contributions are from interest in the financial sector.
It's what they call the FIRE sector, right?
The FIRE sector.
Finance, insurance, and real estate sector.
Absolutely.
Let me get some more calls on. And Joe, thanks for waiting. Join us, Joe. You're on.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I'm all for what the movement represents. It's important. I'm as angry as anybody as to what's happened with the economy and the greed. But I'm just trying to figure out what in the heck is this movement all about? Do we have any intelligent information out there as far as speakers or websites other than maybe Michael Moore in a high-profile sense? But have they come out with a manifesto that we can look at? If you're going to just go out and camp in public places, you know, those of us who still work, we can't do that. We still pay our taxes. And, you know, my whole point is, you know, if it takes more than just sitting and taking a public space. When are you going to come out with something that we can look at that has a real intelligent argument and some voices and some faces that we can look at?
Well, you know, Joe, let me actually read an email here from San Jose, a listener named Robert, and see if this resonates for you. He says, right-wing media such as Fox News is trying to paint the 99% movement as advocating simple communist-style wealth redistribution, but reviewing what the 99% is saying reveals something very different. What the 99% is asking for is for rewards to be based on merit, meaning the value that people produce in their work. They see Wall Street as profiting greatly by gaming the system, but producing very little of value to anyone else. Does that summation seem to at least make sense to you?
You know, when I look at Anonymous, this sort of reminds me of the 99 movement of Anonymous, except that people have their names on it. So if you go up to the Occupy Wall Street site and the 99 sites, you'll see like a bunch of different manifestos. There's just not one. So you'll see one place where people say, forgive all student loans, another place, forgive all debt. You know, there'll be there is at some point in time. A smart political movement decides it's going to embrace a couple ideas and get some people out there running for office. And that shift just hasn't happened yet.
Right. And we have to say we're 3 or 4 weeks into this. You know, if you look back at the civil rights movement, and it was a collection of local movements, you know, in hindsight, we can say, oh, look, the civil rights movement was from point A to point B. But it was, you know, people sitting in at a Woolworths counter. People, the Montgomery bus boycott. It was little actions like that coming around, and there was no manifesto at the beginning of it. But that takes time to coalesce.
You know, what set a lot of things off was the fact that suddenly banks were making ATM charges and things of that sort when these young people, particularly young people, feel that they've been ripped off by the banks.
Absolutely. I mean, the $5 that B of A is charging is ticking off people who are more middle class people, too.
But yeah. There are a lot of Bill Ayers put up a manifesto. You can read it and he put it up on the 99 site. There are a number of different manifestos. There just isn't one.
Bill Ayers has been putting out manifestos ever since Weatherman days,
yeah,
though.
That's
true.
He
wasn't taking that seriously.
And he had an early one, though. He was up early.
That note on Bill Ayers is going to have to bring things to a conclusion here. Let me extend my thanks to Joe Garofoli, Deborah Saunders, Tim Dickinson, and Rinku Sen, who joined us from New York City. Thank you for joining us. We are appreciative of your listenership and those of you who called in and expressed yourself in another hour of Forum coming your way. We're going to talk about Radiolab in the hour ahead. I hope you will join us for that. A lot of Radiolab fans out there, I know, and we'll meet the two co-hosts of that. We're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you again for being a part of this hour. Another one up ahead for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.